Freddie and Volovich. And just to give you the snapshot or the abstract of the talk, the meat of the work is in a very efficient new algorithm for extracting certain quantities, in particular the cusp anomalous dimension, whose importance and properties I'll review, from L-loop gluon amplitudes in N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. Some of our methods do have wider applicability, but our primary interest and motivation for these particular calculations has stemmed from their important impact in recent studies of integrability and iteration relations between multi-loop amplitudes. And concrete calculations are always necessary to test various conjectures and to shed light on hidden structure. Okay, so, but to start at the beginning is Yang-Mills theory, and there are many reasons one could and should be interested in Yang-Mills theory. Of course, it's the unique theory of interacting vector bosons. There's a great deal of interesting mathematics hidden therein. And if I'm allowed to say such a perverse and heretical thing here, it's, of course, eminently applicable to the real world. The journey to solving any theory, especially one as complicated as Yang-Mills theory, is a long journey, but it has been one that has taught us a lot along the way. And like in many areas of physics, if we can't immediately solve the theory we're most interested in, we look for a simpler, similar model that we can solve. And so in particular, I'll be discussing today mostly the N equals 4 supersymmetric version of the theory, which has richer mathematical structure, of course, and is of independent interest because, oops, I went backwards, didn't mean to, and is of independent interest since it is also a theory of quantum gravity. Oh, well,
good question. It depends on what theory you're talking about. So, say, in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, I would consider a solution of N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory to be a procedure that allows you to simply, to basically compute any correlation functions you want. In QCD, I would call a solution of QCD some method of determining, not necessarily analytically, but a systematic way of determining all the Hegrons. Okay, so the motivation for our work was twofold, to unlock previously hidden mathematical structure hiding deep within these multi-loop amplitudes, and to exploit that structure as much as possible to help simplify otherwise impossible calculations. So let me review a few properties of N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. The experts in the field have known for many years that using Feynman diagrams is one of the most painful possible ways to do these computations. There are too many Feynman diagrams. Individual Feynman diagrams are too messy, and they completely hide the structure in amplitudes. A lot of interest in this field and was generated at the end of following Witten's paper in 2003 on twister string theory. In fact, it was until that point, if you dared to give a talk in front of an audience of string theorists talking about the S matrix of N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, you would surely get thrown out of the room.
After Witten's paper, the string theorists, they fidget in their chairs because they almost want to say something, but then in the back of their minds they're thinking, well, Witten wrote a paper on this, so. Okay, so it's an interesting phase transition. Okay, but anyway. And so, in fact, within a period of less than 2 years, the problem of calculating analytic closed-form expressions for tree-level scattering amplitudes for gluons went from possible only in certain special cases to essentially completely solved. And I put a bunch of names here on the board. Many people were responsible, but Freddie's name should appear more than all these other people, if I were giving honest credit here. So let me say a little bit about one-loop amplitudes. So in the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, it's been known for some time that all of the one-loop integrals which can appear in any Feynman diagram can be reduced to a set of scalar box integrals. So just integrals of this form where you have just, a one-loop box. Okay. So another way to say it is that scalar box integrals provide a complete basis for any one-loop amplitude. So if you want to know any one-loop amplitude, all you have to do is determine the coefficients,
So it will be a linear combination of all possible boxes where you arrange the external particles you're interested in around the corners of this box times some coefficient. So all you have to do is determine the coefficient. Now, it's also known that any supersymmetric one-loop amplitude is completely determined by its branch cuts and singularities, so it's useful to use what are called unitarity-based methods or generalized unitarity. Yes, absolutely. Sure. Oops. Yes.
Things that way. Yes. Particular box rules. Are you guaranteed when you do that kind of decomposition that those coefficients always have well-defined transformations under gauge transformations? Because individual terms won't be gauge invariant, right?
No, absolutely. So Feynman diagrams are not individually gauge invariant. Everything here is basically, gauge invariance has been factored out so long ago. I've skipped several steps here. What am I saying? Okay, I said something correct, but it wasn't in. I mean, the amplitude is only the sum of all of these terms. Actually, I don't know the answer. What is the answer to this question?
Oh, the subjects are gauge invariant.
Right. The coefficients are. Oh, that's right. They're scalar. They're just scalar products.
No. This object, this A1 loop that you're writing there, is not the amplitude.
Yeah.
It's a piece of the amplitude, which is gauge invariant. Right? You have factored out all the color structure.
Right. That's what I meant. Yeah, so all of the colors. I'm sorry. Yeah. I wasn't giving the correct answer to the question. When I write this formula, I'm suppressing a factor in front of everything, which is trace of the gauge group generators, cyclically ordered according to the ordering of these momenta here. So all that is factored completely out. These are called color ordered subamplitudes, and so everything here is completely gauge invariant.
Okay. But in particular, that structure is gauge invariant. So if I go to a screwy gauge, I won't end up having to introduce some kind of, a pentagon, right? Or some trend. No. Okay.
Right.
Okay, so each scalar box integral has a unique leading singularity.
In whatever gauge you choose, you will end up with Feynman diagrams that will have pentagons, hexagons,
right,
and everything. But there is a systematic procedure to reduce everything to only boxes.
Okay.
So whatever you do, you will end up with this thing. And
with the same coefficient.
Yes.
Because the coefficients are unique.
Which at this point are undetermined. The procedure doesn't tend to, well, if you did the procedure systematically with the computer, you will get the coefficient, and the coefficient will be gauge invariant.
Okay.
So in principle, it could be done that way.
You're saying that everything on the board was gauge invariant.
Yes.
The box is gauge invariant, the coefficient is gauge invariant, there's a trace, which is obviously gauge invariant, etc. But every single, so not only is the structure as it stands gauge invariant, but actually the individual terms are gauge invariant. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that everything that shows there in that slide is gauge invariant.
Individual. Sounds like.
Yeah, that was
the coefficient on the integral.
Okay, so the important point is that each scalar box integral has a unique leading singularity, though you might have to go to
complex momenta in order to see the full singularity. And the discontinuity of any amplitude across the singularity is given by a quadruple cut, where you cut all four propagators involved in this. And the coefficient of this singularity is the product of the four tree amplitudes sitting at the corner of this box. Okay, so this is the sense in which, using this technique, basically all one-loop amplitudes in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory can be reduced to tree amplitudes, or products of tree amplitudes. Now, it starts getting much more interesting and difficult when you start going to higher loops. So you can generalize the unitarity-based methods. One of the problems, though, is that it's not in general known. So whereas at one loop, there's a classification theorem that says that these boxes are a complete basis for all of your integrals, there's no such theorem known at higher loops. And so you have to sort of work case by case. For any amplitude that you're interested in computing, you have to work out, you know, what are all the possible integrals that can contribute to it, and check that you haven't missed anything by checking all of the possible unitarity cuts. So here's an example that the two-loop amplitude, I'm going to use the letter M to denote the amplitude divided by the tree amplitude so that all of the helicity structure is factored out. I'll review that a little bit more later. The two-loop amplitude is just given by the sum of these two integrals. But as I said, beyond one loop, it's very difficult to determine which integrals contribute to any particular amplitude. And I call this step finding the integrand. So for example, you can use unitarity to show that the two-loop amplitude has to be the sum of these two diagrams. But that doesn't, and okay, and here I've written the expression for one of those diagrams. But unitarity doesn't help you at all in evaluating these integrals. So similarly, when you go up to the four-loop amplitude, it's been shown by unitarity, or generalized unitarity, to be equal to the sum of these eight diagrams, scalar diagrams, more or less. But unitarity doesn't offer much help with evaluating these nasty integrals, and that's what's going to be one of the focuses of my talk. Okay, go ahead, yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah.
So how do you put
it? Okay, so let me back and say that there is sort of a conjecture. There was an old conjecture which hypothesized that we just had these first six diagrams, and that conjecture was proven to be wrong when it was found that there are two more. Okay, now there's a new conjecture, sort of a conjecture, how to do it for any loop. But the systematic way to do it is to either use cleverness or experience or a computer program to draw all the possible integrals you can think of and make an ansatz with some coefficients here. Like, let me guess that the amplitude is going to be equal to some linear combination of all the integrals you can imagine. And then you systematically check all the cuts. You cut both sides of the equation in all possible channels and try to determine all those coefficients. It's a non-trivial project, but it's possible.
So, is it always there people work?
If it can only fail, if it fails, that means you've missed an integral. Your ansatz is not big enough. So here's a status report of the integrands that are currently known and the year of their discovery. The five-loop amplitude was actually constructed earlier this year, and I have a really poor excuse for not including it on this plot. My latest version of Xfig won't open this. So I can't edit. Totally sad, I know, but...
No, but you could also say that it's a conjecture. It hasn't been shown to be correct.
No, they checked the cuts. They checked all the d-dimensional cuts. Or do you question there?
No, they checked some of the... I mean, they said, well, this is reasonable.
Oh, okay. I thought they were more confident than that, but...
Okay.
Okay, we can discuss this later, but I thought they had really proved it. Now I'm going to change gears a little bit, not very much, but talk about the universal infrared behavior of loop amplitudes. So, of course, all these loop amplitudes, because we're in massless theory, they're infrared divergent. And a popular regularization is to go to dimensional regularization. So you let d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon. And some old work by Sturman et al. And Pitani have shown, in massless gauge theories, resummation implies certain relations between amplitudes of different loop orders. So for example, basically, they can be summarized in relations of this form, that the L-loop amplitude...
Here I've written all of the divergent terms in the amplitude, because here I have plus order epsilon to the zero, so plus order finite. So the divergent terms have to organize themselves in a particular way. Namely, there's a term here proportional to some polynomial in the lower loop amplitudes, plus a piece that can be written, if you choose to write it like this, in terms of the one loop amplitude with two numerical coefficients that appear here. Now, these two numerical coefficients are actually well known in other guises. Well, at least one of them is well known. The one that's called f is the FLs are the loop expansion of the function that's called the cusp anomalous dimension that has played an important role in ADS-CFT, as I'll review. Whereas the g coefficients are the coefficients in the loop expansion of a function that can be called the collinear anomalous dimension, although much less is known about it. It's really, a few weeks ago I gave a talk in front of Catani, and I only agreed to give this talk if I asked the organizer, if Zvi Bern actually, if he would personally, during my talk, ask Catani to explain this formula. And he did, and Catani said, oh, but it's obvious, much to the consternation of everyone else in the room. So it takes a special kind of, I don't know, genius to understand this kind of thing. But anyway, it's a true fact, apparently.
You mentioned earlier that you use dimension number of the revision to kind of the IR
divergence. IR divergence, yes. Okay, so let me say a few words about this
cusp anomalous dimension. Here's its behavior through three loops. It's also well known because it governs the behavior of twist two operators, their anomalous dimension, in the limit of very large spin. It's long played an important role in ADS-CFT. Almost 10 years ago, Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov identified a certain string in ADS-5 cross S5 whose energy is f of lambda, thereby providing a prediction for the strong coupling behavior of this function. And more recently, there's been a lot of work on the apparent integrability of planar n equals 4 Yang-Mills, which has culminated in an exact prediction for f of lambda. So the and much less is known about g of lambda, but these two functions are the targets of one of our calculations. So if you keep in mind that the one loop four particle amplitude takes this form, so in particular, I want you to focus on the fact that the leading divergence is a double pole, and there's a subleading divergence that's a single pole. Okay, so if you plug that back into the relation we had before, you see that you can read off, if you know the L loop amplitude, and you know all of the lower loop amplitudes, then you can read off the L loop contribution to F from the 1 over epsilon squared singularity, and you can read off the L loop G function from the 1 over epsilon singularity. And so our interest in exploring these structures was partly motivated by the desire to develop an efficient algorithm for computing these quantities, which I will now describe. Okay, so the pink background denotes that this is the most technical corner of the talk. So the preliminary comments are that we consider the L loop four gluon amplitude in 4-2 epsilon dimensions. As I might have indicated earlier, supersymmetry determines the helicity of this amplitude to be completely the same as that of the tree level amplitude. So if you divide them out to get the ratio, then this thing I called M is only a function of the dimensional regulator epsilon and also the Mandelstam variables S and T. And by crossing symmetry, moreover, it's a symmetric function of S and T. And furthermore, if you work in 4-2 epsilon dimensions, you can use dimensional analysis to see that it should have dimension of length to the 2 epsilon L. So therefore, using all the facts above the last bullet, you find that it's convenient to rewrite or to rescale the amplitude to pull out an overall factor of ST to the epsilon L over 2. Then the resulting function that you have after you pull this out, the resulting function is dimensionless and is invariant under x goes to 1 over x, because I'm defining x to be equal to t over s. So you'll understand almost all of the important aspects of the technical part of this talk if you only remember two variables. The first variable is x, so it's equal to t over s, where t and s are the usual Mandelstam invariants. Typically you do, but you can always rewrite that in this form. You pull it out and you rewrite that as Well, in that example, that would just be x plus 1 over x. I think if I understood you correctly. Yeah. Okay, so of course we're almost always interested in studying amplitudes and expansion around epsilon equals 0. And for an L-loop amplitude, the leading singularity is of the form epsilon to the minus 2L, where higher and higher order terms in the epsilon expansion become more and more complicated. So here's an example of the simplest possible integral, the one loop integral, and I've shown the first few orders in the epsilon expansion. These H's are harmonic polylogarithm functions, which are kind of not very nice. Let's see, anything else? Oh, yeah. So one comment I want to make is an interesting property that you may be familiar with if you've studied anything like this before, that the coefficients, I'm sorry, the terms in this epsilon expansion have a property which is related to what's called transcendentality. So the precise statement is that the coefficient of epsilon to the minus 2L plus K is a linear combination with rational coefficients of terms with transcendentality K. So transcendentality is defined as follows. If you have a harmonic polylogarithm function with k indices, it's defined to have transcendentality k. Log x is defined to have transcendentality 1. A zeta number is defined to have transcendentality k. And finally, they satisfy a product structure, so the transcendentality of AB is that of A plus B. So for example, here you see that these terms are both transcendentality 2. Everything in this big parentheses is transcendentality 3. Everything here is transcendentality 4, etc. Yeah?
So meaning for the terms that vanish, are you taking epsilon to 0? So what?
Very excellent, excellent question. So you might think naively that, oh, well, you know, this regularization it's getting your hands dirty temporarily, because at the end of the day, we want to go back to four dimensions as quick as possible. So you might think, who the heck cares about these higher order terms in the epsilon expansion? But in fact, they're absolutely crucial, all of them, all the way down to infinity, as I'll explain later. Okay, right. So transcendentality allows for a tremendous compression, if you will, in the amount of data required to specify in the amplitude. So what I mean by that is that an amplitude can be expressed not in terms of completely arbitrary functions of x, but rather in terms of a small finite collection of rational numbers. So any L-loop amplitude is characterized by a single number over epsilon to the 2L. Nothing can appear here in our normalization. And then here you can have two coefficients. You can have log squared x, or you can have pi squared. And here you have five objects, you know, log cubed, zeta 3, and three different harmonic polylogarithm functions. Now, it's an unfortunate fact that current technologies for evaluating these integrals completely obscure this structure. It would really be nice. One thing we tried a lot is if there's a way to isolate terms of given transcendentality, so the structure is there magically at the end of the day, and yeah.
Do you understand why the structure's there actually?
I don't really. There are some people who've done some work on that I can point you to. I don't want to say anymore because I'd just be blabbering.
So is it been proven?
Oh no, and certainly it has not been proven. This structure has been observed in every amplitude that's been calculated, but as far as I know, no one has really proven that this has to be true.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just on the next transparency. So what is it? One more. Yeah, so what's the pattern here, 1025? Is there a pattern on
this? Yeah, there's a pattern of the, it's just how many different independent harmonic polylogarithm functions you can write down. It grows roughly like 2 to the n.
Okay.
Asymptotically, I think it's like 2 to the n, maybe slightly higher.
And you genuinely get super difficult. No, is there any pattern between the coefficients?
For different integrals?
For different theories, so would you...
Oh, yeah,
first of all, would they definitely be different?
Yeah. Typically, even within a single theory, if you calculate two, you know, so the four I showed you, some five, these eight diagrams, they all have completely different, mostly different coefficients. Frequently, the leading singularity is the same for all reasonable diagrams, but they start differing quite dramatically later on. Okay, so now, unfortunately, the iterative relations that I wrote a few slides ago imply that you have to sift all the way through the epsilon to the minus 2 term in order to find any new information. Because, just to review, this little piece here that contains the new information, f and g, only starts at order 1 over epsilon squared. All of the higher singularities are completely fixed in terms of lower loop amplitudes. So that's what I mean here when I say these are all fixed. You know, supposing you knew all the amplitudes up to, but not including L loops, this would all be fixed. And here we would be fixed plus one unfixed number, that's F, and here it's G. And here it's a combination of F and G. But okay, so it would be, again, this kind of pattern, okay. There's an exciting recent development, but until recently, this pattern was also completely obscured in loop amplitudes. You really had to add up a whole bunch of mess in order to see that the iteration relations work, and then you can
pop out these numbers that you're interested in. But anyway, it would sure be nice if we could develop some kind of technology which would let us isolate these particular numbers we're interested in and calculate only them and not the rest of this garbage. For example, it would be great if there were a procedure to isolate all of the integrals, say, which contribute to a particular coefficient. Let's say you're interested in the coefficient of this harmonic polylogarithm and you expect it to be some rational number. Well, wouldn't it be great if there were a simple way of extracting what that rational number has to be without doing, you know, a whole bunch of horrible work. It's not really clear whether that's possible. However, what I'll show you is surprisingly possible is the algorithm we developed for reading off rather efficiently the coefficient of any term that's simply a power of log x. And remarkably, perhaps not coincidentally, these are precisely the terms that we're interested in when we talk about the cusp anomalous dimension. Oops, sorry. Because these f and g coefficients multiply the one loop amplitude, so everything is expressed in terms of logarithms here. So if we can calculate just all of the terms that involve logarithms, then we can calculate f and g. Okay, so now I'll say a few words about how we go about doing this. The first step is to observe the fact that dimensionally regulated L-loop four-particle integrals can typically be written in what's called a Mellon-Barnes representation. I won't go into very much detail, but this is a well-known particular integral representation where you have an integral that goes along the imaginary axis. So there's a contour that goes along the imaginary axis. And the very nice thing is that the kinematic dependence is isolated as x to the y here times some function of y comma epsilon. And because of the x goes to 1 over x symmetry, this is symmetric and y goes to minus y. Now the reason that this is a useful step is because it's more or less trivial to determine for any loop integral you're interested in what this function f is. I mean, even this example, if you asked me to, I could plug it into Mathematica, and in a minute or two, I could tell you what this f function is. In contrast, the thing that makes evaluating these integrals so difficult is the final integration over y. That's really the most difficult step. Okay, so as an example that's not representative of the general case because it's so simple, but it's nevertheless an example, for the one loop amplitude, f of y comma epsilon is exactly given by this expression that involves a product of six gamma functions. That's it. That's all there is. And the one loop amplitude is exactly equal to this integral of those six gamma functions. And that's a much nicer way of presenting the amplitude than this infinite list of garbage. Okay, so that's step one, which I keep up here as a reminder. Now, step two is that if we want to study imagine you want to use some kind of iterative relation, it's tempting to combine all of the different terms in your iterative relation inside this y integral and combine them at the level of the f's. Typically, this is not possible because these functions f of y comma epsilon have poles which collide with the integration contour as you take epsilon goes to zero. So here is the one loop example again, and you see very well that if you take the limit epsilon goes to zero, you have poles here which are collapsing onto your integration contour. So this fact signals that expanding an epsilon and performing the y integral do not commute. So you're not allowed to combine everything inside the y integral and then expand an epsilon. Okay, we called these, historically we were annoyed by these terms, so we called them obstructions. Later we realized how great these terms are because they're precisely the terms we're interested in, so maybe in retrospect we should have given them a more positive name. But we called them obstructions because they are the terms that obstruct our ability to collect everything under a single y integral. Now, the singularities that appear at y equals zero are always of the form, they're always poles, either a first order pole or a higher pole. And you can isolate them, you can split them off by using this well-known formula. This formula may look like it's missing some factors of I, but that's because y is going along the imaginary axis again. Okay, so if you do this, if you isolate all of the poles using this formula, you pull them apart, you can uniquely express any amplitude as a sum of two functions. One here that has a principal value integral, so there are no problems with poles on the integration contour, and the second term that contains all of the poles. Now, the remarkable thing is that these poles are precisely the terms that when you go back to X space, evaluate to polynomials and logarithms. And that's simply because the Mellin transform of any derivative of a delta function is just the power of log x. And in fact, because of our x goes to 1 over x symmetry, you'll always have an even polynomial in logs. Okay, so what I've shown you so far is that there's a canonical way to separate any amplitude and write it as a sum of two pieces. One are what we call the obstructions. These are the singular parts of the amplitude's Mellin transform and correspond to a polynomial in log squared x to the amplitude. And then there's what's left over, this term with the principal value integral. And that's a smooth integral. It's the smooth part of the Mellin transform. And that's the term that corresponds in x space to the harmonic polylogarithms. Now, what makes this decomposition really useful is that it obeys a product algebra. So if you take any obstruction times an obstruction, you get an obstruction. And that's easy to see because multiplication, when you go to y space, becomes convolution. And if you convolve two delta functions, you get another delta function. However, if you convolve a delta function with something smooth, or two things that are smooth, you get something smooth. So this is very nice because remember that in our iteration relation here, we have some polynomial in the lower loop amplitudes. But because our obstructions satisfy a product algebra, we can individually compute the obstruction in each of these amplitudes and then just plug them into that polynomial. So let me give you some specific examples. Here are the one loop amplitude through order epsilon to the fourth, truncated to what we call the obstructions. So you'll only see polynomials and logs here. This is the one loop, two loop, and here's the three loop amplitude. And you can plug these in and check that these separately satisfy the iteration relations. So to summarize, in order to read off the L loop cusp anomalous dimension, we don't need to calculate the entire amplitude. It is sufficient to start with the far simpler Mellin transform and just read off the coefficient of the leading singularity, delta y over epsilon squared, since it's the only one that can possibly contribute to the cusp anomalous dimension. Okay, so and we implement this as an algorithm in Mathematica. So the punchline is, here's the for loop iteration relation. And you know, I'm just repeating what I said again to get the point across. We don't need to separately calculate both sides of this equation as complicated functions of x and then rely on some delicate cancellation to extract that number. We just throw away all the terms we're not interested in. And this is a good time for me to address your question of the role that's played by the higher order terms in the epsilon expansion. So notice here you have the for loop amplitude, which has singularities starting from 1 over epsilon to the 8th. And we're interested in the 1 over epsilon squared term. Now here's m1 to the 4th. m1 starts at order, let me write it, well, if I could, there's some chalk. Yeah, m1 starts like 1 over epsilon squared plus higher terms. So if you want to take m1 to the 4th power, right, this is going to be, minus 2 to the 4th over epsilon to the 8th plus dot, dot, dot. But you need to know, in order to use this relation successfully, you need to know what goes here at 1 over epsilon squared. And that means you need to keep this to very high order. You need to go past the terms that are finite, you need to include terms that vanish at epsilon equals 0. This is an important fact that's frequently overlooked in various guises in this literature. But so here are the results. As application of this method, we obtained the for loop cusp anomalous dimension. The final step involved a numerical integration, which is why these results are only given numerically. In very good agreement with the BES conjecture, and a significant improvement over the Byrne, Chacon, Dixon, Kossauer, Smirnov result, who had less precision. And again, to emphasize, the reason for the improvement in our precision is that we only need to compute not the full amplitude, just the terms which we know contribute. And here's our calculation of the for loop coefficient in G4, which is thanks to SharkNet computer cluster that we had access to thanks to Freddy. Okay, so now finally, in the last 20 minutes, I want to move on to the ADS-CFT part of my talk. So recall this iterative formula that I've written here between the multi-loop gluon amplitudes. Now, in fact, similar relations hold in any gauge theory. There's some modifications if you have a gauge theory with a beta function or with matter content. But more or less, a very similar kind of relation holds in any gauge theory. And again, it just has to do with the consistency of resummation and the infrared singularities. However, something special happens in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, or something is conjectured to happen. Namely, that this plus order epsilon to the 0 term is actually something more special. It's actually conjectured to be plus a constant plus order epsilon. Where a constant really means constant. So it's a number completely independent. You know, you could have 17 gluons coming in, and that is a constant independent of all their momenta. This conjecture has only been checked in 3 limited cases, 4 particles at 2 and 3 loops, and 5 particles at 2 loops. And it seems like kind of an innocent modification of this formula, but the consequence is actually quite remarkable. If it's true to all loops, then it implies that the all loop planar, I should have mentioned this, this is only supposed to be true for planar amplitudes. Four particle amplitude sums up to something like this. I've taken one or two very small liberties in writing this equation, which the experts in the audience will surely see, but more or less it's true. What I'm trying to emphasize is that the cusp anomalous dimension appears here both as the 1 over epsilon squared term and in terms of this finite piece, in front of this finite piece here. This particular formula is what's called the BDS-Ansatz after Bern, Dixon, Smirnov. If you believe that something like this is true to all loops, then you should expect that you might be able to provide some ADS-CFT. Well, you might ask the question, what does ADS-CFT have to say about it, if anything? And recently, Alde and Maldacena have given a prescription for using ADS-CFT to calculate gluon scattering amplitudes at strong coupling. Here again, there's the same sociological lesson that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, right? So if you would ever give a talk in front of a string theory audience and you say that you want to use dimensional regularization in N equals Fourier and Mills theory, they'd look at you like you're insane. Here you have this beautiful, non-perturbatively well-defined conformal field theory that's dual to a theory of gravity, quantum gravity, and you want to pollute it by using dimensional regularization? Okay, but then Juan comes along and, you know, dimensionally regularizes ADS5 to ADS5 plus epsilon, and all of a sudden it's the most obvious thing in the world to do, right? Okay, so there's my little sociological rant. But anyway, okay, so they gave a prescription for using ADS-CFT to calculate gluon scattering amplitudes at strong coupling, and for four particles, an explicit calculation they performed yields precisely this structure here, including the precise numerical coefficients. If you take the, so I said before that the strong coupling behavior of F of lambda is known. It's been known for some time due to Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Alde and Maldacena reproduce the correct numerical coefficients. And incidentally, they get a strong coupling prediction for this G function. For more than four particles, so the BDS ansatz, I should have said, I've written it here for four particles, but there's a similar kind of statement that has been conjectured to be true for any number of particles. If you go to beyond four particles, the ADS-CFT calculation gets much more tricky and is in general an open problem. The singularity structure has been looked at by Yevgeny for any number of particles. Although the latest information is that Juan is pretty sure that it's actually this ansatz is false once you go to six particles, but we can maybe discuss that later. Okay, so the Alde-Maldacena prescription is actually computationally equivalent to evaluating a certain Wilson loop composed of null line segments. So the statement is the following. If you want to use ADS-CFT to calculate a gluon scattering amplitude, okay, I give you my four gluons. Each gluon has some momentum. The momentum is a null vector, and they add up to zero by momentum conservation. So here on the boundary, I have, this is on the boundary, I've drawn ADS-3 here, but you imagine you have on the boundary of ADS-5 your four light-like momenta. They form a closed loop because they add up to zero, and you want to find the minimal area surface whose boundary sits on that wire frame. This particular surface, the solution for the surface was actually found a few years ago by Kruchensky, who was using it to study the cusp anomalous dimension in ADS-CFT. And so what Alde and Maldacena really did is give a new interpretation of that solution as a four-particle scattering amplitude. And so what you do, you regulate, just like as if you were going to calculate a Wilson loop, you regulate the action of this worldsheet, this classical solution, and then the amplitude is equal, the log of the amplitude is just equal to that regulated action. And incidentally, as I said, they get a prediction for the strong coupling behavior of this G function.
So obviously, if you want to match two things that are regulator dependent, this is regulator dependent because in gauge theory I chose a dimensional regularization. So you had better do the same regulator on the gravity side. And they do the same thing. They do dimensional regularization. It's a little bit trickier that they motivate this through a different way. They motivate it by starting with a regulator that's D-brain sitting at a very large value of the ADS radius, ZIR, and then the gluons are the excitations on that D-brain. Then they do a T-duality, which moves you from very far in the middle of ADS to very near the boundary. So that's why here I've got my string world sheet very near the boundary. But then at the end of the day, they relate this. So the infrared regulator is really just pushing it a little bit in from the boundary. But they relate that dimensional regularization so that they can compare to this expression.
So ZIR is somehow related to epsilon?
Yes.
So how should I think about the ones that strong coupling? So the idea here is what you just said is probably, so I have a theory in which I might not necessarily have a quasi particle or something that I would interpret as gluons, but
right.
Then I introduce a probe.
Absolutely.
Probe gluons, and so this thing is escaping on this probe.
Absolutely.
On the background of strongly interacting stuff.
Right, because normally in N equals 4, we don't talk about colored objects.
Right, you should not be able to do
that. You should not, this should not have worked.
This is, so this is planar, or this is planar ADS, right?
Yeah.
So this is an amplitude in R4.
Right.
And no one's been concerned with a calculation like this for super Yang mills on some different space.
Not as far as I know. I mean, when you talk, I don't quite understand your question because
regularization. Because when you do planar ADS, So if I change the dimension of ADS 5 to ADS 5 plus epsilon or something like that. Then you get new divergences when you calculate these actions that aren't just there for ADS 5. And they won't contribute anything to the final answer if you just need like planar ADS where your boundary is essentially completely flat. But if you had something that had a non-trivial conformal anomaly, you would actually get new finite terms
for
the action.
Absolutely. Now, on the gauge theory side, I wouldn't know. When you talk about correlation functions, which is what you usually do in N equals 4, then you can put N equals 4 on any manifold you like. You can have correlation functions on R plus S3, whatever. But when we're talking about the S matrix, we've already sort of limited ourselves to R4. So you have to develop a whole other formalism and technology if you wanted to do some other
background, but definitely this is all special to the case where it's an R4, or rather R4 minus epsilon background.
In this particular case, the S5 plays basically no role.
So are you going to do the D11 with the
S1? I think so. Maybe you should discuss that. Okay, so here's a, if you take now all of the input that's known, okay, so it was actually Huang's paper that motivated us
to quickly fire up SharkNet and try to do this calculation. So now armed with the known behavior of G of lambda through four loops and the strong coupling prediction of due to Alde Maldacena, we can, just for fun, we can write a Padé approximate for G of lambda based on all available data. One interesting, it turns negative and then goes positive, asymptoting to square root lambda. But this is a kind of unfamiliar, this G function is much less familiar than the cusp anomalous dimension. The cusp anomalous dimension, as I said, has been studied for many, many, I mean, well, not just in ADS-CFT. Already in QCD, the analogous anomalous dimension quantifies violations to Bjorkane scaling. So it's been studied for a long, long time. But even in ADS-CFT, it's been studied a long time. And there's been a lot of integrability literature on F. In contrast, much, much less is known about this observable G of lambda. And it's an interesting open problem to try to relate it to more familiar kinds of observables that one might compute from integrability, for example.
Yeah, it has a mild regulator dependence. G is only defined up modulo, so G can be identified G mod G plus psi f. If you change your infrared renormalization scale, you shift your G function by set constant volume.
But do you think it can be related to integrability?
It's a speculation. I actually know a partial answer to this question. George Sturman has finally, he says, identified an operator whose anomalous dimension is G. Okay, so for F of lambda, I wrote down a gauge invariant single trace operator, twist two operator, whose anomalous dimension is F. Now in unpublished work, George claims he knows the
operator. So what is the role of this non-uniqueness?
I don't know anything more. You know all I know. Well, except that his operator is a non-local operator. Which might make connection to integrability difficult, because the integrability people, as far as I know, are always interested in local operators. His operator is more like a Wilson, as you might expect, you know, given what role G is supposed to play. There are many interesting open questions in this subject. The Albright model saying a prescription reveals that the four-particle amplitude is equal, at least it's strong coupling, to a Wilson loop composed of
null line segments. Now, there's been some really interesting work last couple months indicating that this could be true also at weak coupling as well. There's a typo in my slide. It should say in red, could this actually be true at weak coupling as well? Because Alde-Malasena showed it was certainly true at strong coupling. And that this has been called Wilson loop / amplitude duality or something like that. So clearly there's an interesting story there remaining to be told. And a very important role in this story is apparently played by a mysterious symmetry of planar scattering amplitudes that I unfortunately don't have much time to talk about, but it's called dual conformal symmetry. Now, it's been observed through five loops that the particular integrals such as these, which contribute to the amplitude, are those and only those integrals that you can draw that have a peculiar property called dual conformal invariance. It basically means that they're invariant under conformal transformations in momentum space. So this is a symmetry that apparently has nothing to do, apparently, with the normal conformal symmetry of N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, because you're doing it in momentum space. And also, it's only true for the planar amplitudes, not for the non-planar piece. Now, in the Alde-Maldesena setup at strong coupling, this dual conformal symmetry is more or less manifest. I said very quickly that one step in their construction involves taking a T-duality along the four directions of ADS-5 parallel to the boundary. And when you T-dualize ADS-5 in this way, you get ADS-5 again. And the dual conformal symmetry is actually just the isometry of that T-dualized ADS-5. And this symmetry is partially responsible for fixing the form of the BDS ansatz. And I'm sure in the next few months you'll hear a lot more about this in various guises. So the conclusion is that we developed some techniques to aid in direct tests of the conjectured planar N equals 4 Yang-Mills S matrix and the multi-loop iteration relations. As an application, we computed the for loop cusp and collinear anomalous dimensions. The motivation behind this research is the desire to explore and uncover the rich mathematical structure underlying N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. And discovering such structure frequently has the pleasant side benefit of making previously difficult calculations much simpler. And of course, the prospects are great for continued progress, both in supersymmetric gauge theories and hopefully also QCD eventually. There's certainly a lot to discover, so thanks.
Any questions?
So, this is probably very dependent, but when you say you equalize the NK5, what do you mean? Or what do you mean?
Maybe we can maybe discuss that later, but just T-duality. You can always T-dualize.
I mean, since you have a large space.
Are you worried because it's not compact?
Yeah,
that's not a problem because T-duality is based. At the fundamental level, T-duality is a way to rewrite certain equations of motion by change of variables to other equations of motion. So,
and how does a G-string change under
that? Under this, it's under it doesn't change.
It doesn't change.
Yeah.
I see. But then,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In the T-dual coordinates, yes, the dilaton become so. In normal E in the ABS-5 string solution, the dilaton is a constant. When you T-dualize it this way, the dilaton becomes non-constant. But at leading order at strong coupling, you don't have to worry about that for this particular calculus.
So can I think about that as a manifestation that why this thing only holds at the planar level?
I don't think that has anything to do with planar level.
Why not? It would be a G-string correction to live in the string language.
Yeah.
You would talk to the
If you wanted to try to see this kind of structure, if you try to explore the non-planar, you certainly have to worry about this dilaton.
Okay.
But, okay, I see. Okay, that might be an interesting way to think about it. Certainly. I mean, from a weak coupling point of view, it's pretty clear that none of this holds. I shouldn't be so negative. It's not clear that there's any such structure to the non-planar.
Is it known that it's not there, or
it's known that it's not there in the precise formula that I've written. Now, whether or not you can write some different formula that's a little bit more complicated, it's not known. And some people are optimistic about that. Some people are pessimistic. So take your pick. But there could be some structure for the non-planar pieces to it.
What role has supersymmetry played in all this?
What role has what?
Supersymmetry played in all this?
Absolutely crucial. Yeah, so I mean, even going back here, at one loop, this fact that you can relate everything to box integrals is only true in supersymmetric theories.
Another ABS calculation.
In the ABS calculation, a very interesting point, yeah. In this calculation, basically no role is played. In the Aldrich-Maltzsaint calculation, doesn't rely on supersymmetry at all, yeah. It's just the area of the classical solution of the sigma model.
So doesn't that suggest that it is fixed by the ABS sigma model?
Yeah.
Irrespective of the series.
You said it. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
What was the statement? No, the statement is that if you don't use anything but ABS-5 geometry, it seems to be that.
Conformal symmetry is a little confusing.
You're not using it. It would work for any other ABS 5 type something.
Even Markowski.
You need a genuine constant conformal.
Yeah,
but you're saying that there are theories you can write down ABS
lifetime sum.
There is still a specific.
So the fact that you're using
ADS... It's 5.65.
So using ADS is just giving you some clever way of exploiting something that was already there and that's informal.
But you know what, maybe the super simple, for example, if I would take an orbital just to add, bring along some nice line of question. So if I take the structure that's used, how much does it push up? If I take a theory by modding out and killing supersymmetry by discrete transformations?
Well, apparently not. I mean, if you're talking about transformations on the sphere, none of this depended on.
I mean, we'll end up with one of our lambda corrections.
Yeah,
then you're having to write out the equation on the internal.
Right.
That's not in the planar.
No, planar, but one of our lambda.
The fact that you have to do a key duality in this calculation, does that mean that it really is only going to work when you have something that's just pure ADS all the way through from boundary to
it? It is a special property of ADS5 that the T dual of ADS5 is again ADS5, albeit with the curve.
Even so, it's like kind of asymptotic with ADS5, which has some mild going on, might not work since you.
If you took something that was asymptotically ADS5, but some garbage in the middle, and T-dualized it, then you would probably get some different garbage than what you started with. But it might be delicious.
Why do you call it garbage on frame?
Oh, yeah, that's my bias, right?
We're making a point when you say that you have to work with 5 plus epsilon. Rather than 5 minus epsilon.
I was just being sloppy with the tongue.
I see.
Usually the convention in gauge theory is that you call it 4 minus 2 epsilon,
right.
But epsilon is always negative. You always want to go above 4 dimensions.
Right. Okay.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.